Well, I want to say hi to everybody that's in this room and folks at all of our campuses and people joining us online from all over the place. We're looking at community, looking at life together. I was reading a book a while ago. It's quite extraordinary. It's called The Deep Down Dark. Some of you remember, it's the story of these 33 Chilean miners who got trapped in a mine, this giant stone, twice the weight of the Empire State Building came crashing through for 69 days. They're trapped underground in the dark, very little food. They don't know whether they're going to live or die. There's a newspaper in Santiago that put the probability of their survival at 2%. And so they're staring death in the face, and they find that they're taking stock of their lives, and they have a lot of regrets. And then there was kind of a surprising moment. They ask one of them, a guy named Jose Enriquez, and he's a follower of Jesus, and they ask him if he would pray. So they're in the bottom of this mine, a couple thousand feet down. He gets on his knees. Some of the guys get down on their knees, and he prays. And his prayer begins like this: "We aren't the best of men, Lord, but have pity on us." And that's kind of a scratchy way to start a prayer. But the guys are not offended, and he actually goes on and gets even more specific about their failures. Victor Segovia knows he drinks too much. Victor Zamora is too quick to anger. Pedro Cortez thinks about the poor father he's been to his daughter. And the most amazing thing happens. Something's kind of born. They're thousands of feet underground, staring death in the face in the deep down dark. A kind of fellowship begins. And these 33 guys gather every day. And they have a little meal, just a little tuna, cookie or two, a little oily water. And they listen to teachings from God's word. They start to call Jose El Pastor. And he'll tell them stories. And then they pray, they worship God, and they start to confess. Just spontaneously, one of them will pray, "God, forgive me for raising the way that I have raised my voice in violence against my wife and my family." Or, "God, forgive me for the way that I have abused my body with drugs and with alcohol." And then those prayers kind of morph, and they begin to actually do confession with each other. And one of them will say, "Would you please forgive me for the way that I spoke about you, or the way that I raised my hand against you, or the way that I didn't help with the water like I should have?" It's really extraordinary. While that's going on, unknown to them, there's a rescue operation happening way above them. And there's these eight guys that are part of a drill unit. And they're going to try to drill down to rescue these miners. And before they do, the guy that's the head of that little drill team decides that they ought to pray. He says, "Hey, guys, we ought to pray." So they all stop to pray. And I just like the way he puts this. He says, "Let's put all our trust in the skinny guy." Meaning, of course, the skinny guy on the cross. And another guy says, "Hey, we ought to join hands." So these eight burly Chilean construction guys are joining hands. And they pray. And they start the drill. And they get a hole going all the way down. At first, it's quite small. So it's just enough to get supplies, food and water, and iPads and stuff to the miners. And no, it really is. That's part of what they get down there. And the miners realize they're eventually going to be saved. And they find out they're getting famous all around the world. And they start thinking, "Man, if we're famous, maybe we're going to get rich through all of this." And the strangest thing happens. You'll never guess. Meeting together every day to confess their sins to each other kind of stops. And all 33 of them meeting every day to pray together every day kind of stops. Somehow, the knowledge that they're going to be okay, that they're not desperate anymore, and the lure of fame and possible wealth kind of undoes this remarkable community that they knew when they were suffering. And in some ways, the happiest part of the story is kind of the saddest. In some ways, they were at their best when life was at its hardest, at its worst. That's the deep down dark. The deep down dark you all know about, or if you don't, you will. It's when you get to the place where you're stuck. It's when you get to the place where you realize human sufficiency ain't going to cut it. Deep down dark is the place where I realize I need God. And it's so interesting. We're reading this book, Life Together. Dietrich Bonhoeffer is in Nazi-occupied Germany with this little underground crew of guys. And they discover in danger and risk an intensity of fellowship they never knew when they were safe. Y'all have seen this happen. Some guy binges for the 100th time. And he's lost his family and he's lost his job and he knows he's going to die. And he stumbles into an AA meeting. And he finds in the honesty and the rawness of that meeting a fellowship, a community that's got the power to save that he never knew when he was on his own. Somebody gets cancer. Somebody suffers a loss. Somebody loses their job or they go bankrupt or their reputation gets shattered or another person rips their heart out and somehow they find other people and there's a community that they discover that they never knew when life was okay. That's the fellowship of the deep down dark. And I want to talk for a few moments about the fellowship of the deep down dark because you need it and invite you to be a part of it and invite you to extend it to other people. I'll give you four observations about the fellowship of the deep down dark. And here's the first one. In the fellowship of the deep down dark, community, being connected, is non-optional. Now, we live in a day where a lot of people are networked and connected and linked in and still really lonely. Mother Teresa says loneliness is like the leprosy of our age. And it's lethal. It's lethal for every creature at every level. I was just reading about a mouse, that if they put a mouse in a group of strangers in a situation where there's not enough food or water, that little mouse's blood pressure will go way up. They put that little wrappy thing around the little mouse's arm and its blood pressure just skyrockets. I don't know how they read it. But if they put that same mouse in the same situation only with his brothers and sisters, his blood pressure doesn't go up at all. We're made for community and we suffer without it. We can die without it. Robert Putnam, researcher, did the classic study on community for our generation. It's called Bowling Alone. It's a great book. But he found that isolated people, people not in community, are 3 times more likely to die than people that are embedded in deep communal relationships. Not just that. You know, we're all crazy about physical fitness and you got to live a healthy lifestyle and so. Tell you how important community is to your life. Is what Putnam found. People who had bad health habits, smoking, bad eating habits, obesity, alcohol use, bad health habits, but strong social ties lived significantly longer than people who had great health habits out jogging and stuff, but we're isolated. In other words, it is better for you to eat creme brulee with good friends than eat Brussels sprouts alone. Yeah, I thought there'd be a little applause around that one. Yeah. Like, thank God some of you came just to hear that, you know. Go home and binge out with my friends. They did another study. This was actually right here in the Bay Area. I'm not making this up. It's unbelievable. This is just about being connected in community and what it does for your body, for your physical well-being. People with strong emotional connections. They got people who were actually willing to be infected with a virus that causes the common cold. People with strong emotional connections, relationally connected, did 4 times better fighting off illness than those who were more isolated. These people, relationally connected people, were less susceptible to colds, had less virus, and I don't know how they measured this, produced significantly less mucus than relationally isolated subjects. It is literally true. Unfriendly people are snottier than friendly people. I don't know, like, who dreamed up how they're going to... If Putnam said, if you make no other change, you don't start, you know, working out, you don't start eating better, you make no other change, but join a small group when you were not in a small group before, you cut the odds of your dying this year in half. No kidding. That's why around here we call them life groups. Yes, if you like life, you know, get in a group. Join a life group or die, basically, is kind of the way that it is. And this is not just true for your body. It's way more true for your spiritual well-being, for your heart, for your well-being with God. And there's all kinds of statements about this in the Bible. This is from a book called the Hebrews, Letter of the Hebrews. Let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds, not giving up meeting together. Guys, this is what people do. It gets hard, it gets bumpy, it gets fractious, it gets difficult. Not giving up meeting together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another. And all the more as you see the day approaching. Nancy and I have been part of a life group since we've been in our church for the last 12 plus years. There's an era in our life, like deep, dark, down era, where we were facing a pain that was so bad, I often would pray to God, God, if you would answer this one prayer, I would trade everything else in my life. I understand life doesn't work that way, but I would give up everything else I get to do if I could get this pain taken away. I can remember very, very clearly many times thinking, God, if you would answer this one prayer, I would never complain again. Like, this is so painful. If you would answer this, I would never complain. And to have a group, a little fellowship that was for us in that era, the fellowship of the deep down dark, where we could go and I could get mad. I could get mad at God. I could be confused. I could be afraid. I could name it. Nance could do that in real wrong ways, real raw ways. And people would just say, we love you. We're with you. We'll pray for you in times that it felt like, I don't even know how to pray. I don't know how to have gotten through it. And then one day, it doesn't always happen this way, but in this case it did, God moved and God answered, and what I was praying for actually happened. Do you think I have ever complained again since then? Yeah, because my life's really hard. Not really. But I cannot imagine going through that era without that little group. Now, here's the thing. If you want to be encouraged by people, you got to show up. And sometimes people just don't. There's a couple at our church that just kind of floated for a while when it came to community, and then they got intentional about it. And what they didn't know was they were headed for the deep down dark. And this is their story. Take a look at the screens.
So my business is medical devices, and so I'm surrounded by cancer and surgery all the time. And so when I first started feeling a little bit funny, my vision felt a little bit off. And it just took the longest time for anybody to take me seriously. I was told to give up caffeine. I was told that it was stress. I was told that I was working too hard. And it was only through perseverance that I finally got an MRI scan. And I'll never forget this. We were on vacation and I expected the MRI scan to come back clear and it was just something. But I remember picking up a voicemail. In fact, I think it was even Lisa that picked up the voicemail that said, Mr. Lindquist, we want to talk to you about your scan. We found an area, an interesting area, is how they described it. A tumor or a growth in an area of my brain, and they wanted to do follow-ups on it, obviously. And so we determined that the best course for the type of tumor that I had was to get surgery first and then to be followed by radiation. And so we were living in this land of uncertainty where we had no idea if I was going to live or die based on this thing. And I will tell you, it was a hard, hard 9 months. It was hard on me, it was hard on Lisa, it was hard on our marriage, it was hard on our kids. And I will say, honestly, that's where community came into play. And we had people come alongside us that supported us, that prayed for us, that made meals for us.
Yeah, I just remember kind of going along, just doing what I had to do. And it was really like the Mothers Together group was the ones that pushed back on me. I remember for Eric's third surgery, it turned out my mom had cancer at the same time, and she had to have surgery 7 days after him at the same hospital. And so I was pretty tired and kind of just running around. And I remember showing up for a board meeting for the Mothers Together group and just kicking into gear of, okay, here's the agenda, and going through that. And they stopped me and said, Lisa, you gotta let us care for you. And that was really hard for me to do. I felt like I was supposed to be strong. And I remember they all stood up and came around me, and they put their hands on me and prayed and, you know, just said, what's going on? But it was a moment of kind of challenging that I had to let down and let people in. And that group brought me meals, brought us meals for 2 months. I didn't have to cook anything for 2 months. And again, I kept saying to them, I'm not the sick one, I can cook. I remember really clearly Amy C. looked at me and said, Lisa, this is what we do. This is what we want to do. You need to let us do this.
It's so easy to say everything's fine. And it was so hard for Lisa to accept help. It was really hard for me to accept that people wanted to pray for me. It was hard for me to accept that I couldn't do it on my own. And to get over that F word, that fine word, and to allow people into your life that want to help, that feel compelled to help, that's what community does.
And it's such a cool story. Eric's doing great, family's doing great, but it's so interesting. The number one excuse for folks when people will say, you know, I can't get into community consistently is, I just don't have time. I have too many things to do. I got too much on my plate. I just don't have time. And people will live with that sometimes for years. And then one day a crisis hits and they lose a marriage or they lose their health or they lose a job. And all of a sudden they realize, man, I got a lot of time, but I don't have a community. And I just want to say, you know, the deep dark down is coming, and the time to create a community that will see you through the crisis when the crisis hits is before the crisis hits, and other people need it too. So in the deep dark down, community is non-optional. Next observation, in the fellowship of the deep dark down, people are non-optimal. And this is just true about us. You know, a lot of times we get into Christian community, we think people are going to be great, they're going to be, you know, mature, they're going to be healthy, they're going to agree with me, they're going to make me feel great about myself. And then you actually get into Christian community, you find out everybody is non-optimal. Look at the person next to you right now, real quickly. Just take a look. They are non-optimal. That is a non-optimal person, seriously. And we're messed up. You don't have to tell them they're non-optimal. They just are. We're messed up. Nobody's perfect. Everybody's welcome, but nobody's perfect. And the great commandment that we get to follow here is written by the Apostle Paul. Accept one another then, just as Christ accepted you. How did Christ accept me? Just the way I am, messed up, imperfect, flawed. Not in order to live a longer life, you probably will. Not in order to live a better life, you probably will. In order to bring praise to God. When we experience community and extend community, God is honored. God is glorified. And that's why we do it. But it's going to be with messed up people that are hard for you to get along with. Just one dimension. There's hundreds of them. People are different from each other because some people are introverts. Some people are extroverts. If you're an introvert, even this series, a lot of times church is kind of hard for introverts because you feel like, man, all this talk about community and being with people and hanging out with people, and I'd rather be alone, and I feel like church is just built for extroverts. If you're an introvert, the time in the service you hate the most is greeting time, when you have to go around and greet other people. You hate that. You would rather go through a second offering than actually having to greet people during a church service. And then it just feels like it's just all about people. So interesting. They did a survey at a Christian university where they asked students, do you think Jesus was an introvert or an extrovert? 97% of the students said they thought Jesus was an extrovert. And, of course, that's not in the Bible, and it's hard. I'm an introvert. My marriage, one person's an extrovert. My wife, I'm an introvert. And that will be just challenges on our relationship. For example, in our relationship, when I start a sentence, I kind of like to finish the sentence. It's quirky, I know, but it's kind of like if I go to the store, I like to get to the store. If I start a sentence, I like to get to the end of the sentence. It makes me feel good. And Nance is an extrovert who has never had an unexpressed thought or feeling in her life. And for her, interruption is her love language. She just feels like that's the way she says, I love you. And I sometimes wish she loved me a little bit less, but That's something we just got to accept with each other. Because I'm an introvert, I'm an internal processor. That means usually I'll think about something before I say it because I want to know, is it true? Do I mean it? Do I believe it? Nance is such an extrovert that until she says something, she doesn't know if she actually believes it. And so she'll do that and say something. Then it turns out she doesn't believe it. And I try to help her by saying, honey, that's lying. And she'll say, no, that's not lying. I'm just external processing. And I wish the Ten Commandments said, thou shalt not external process to thy neighbor. But it's not in there. But here's the deal. You get into community with people, and I'll talk with folks, and they get all these romanticized ideas, and then it's hard. And there's somebody there, and they're chippy or they're scratchy. I don't like their politics, or I don't like their theology. I don't like how they talk about their faith, or they talk too much, or they never talk, or they hide, or they get their feelings hurt, or Here's the deal. Christian community doesn't mean you get to be with people that are easy to be with. It means you get to be with Jesus with people. And Jesus says, wherever two or three are gathered in my name, there I am in the midst of them. It's very cool. There was an old rabbinic saying, Jesus was deliberately tweaking it, that said, wherever two or three people in Israel are gathered reading Torah, the divine presence is there. And Jesus says, no, what the Torah, what the scriptures were pointing to has now arrived and it's me. So whoever you are, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, when you're gathered together in my name, recognizing that it's not just me and you, it's me and Jesus and you, it's you and Jesus and me. Then Jesus says, I'm right there. Third observation. In the fellowship of the deep down dark, honesty is non-negotiable. And guys, especially in the church, that ought to be so true. Whatever places in the world involve posturing and pretending, not with us. And that's the real power of aloneness. This is what Bonhoeffer writes. In confession, the breakthrough to community takes place. The mask you wear before others will do you no good. You do not have to go on lying to yourself and your brothers, which we all do. You can dare to be a sinner, which we all are, but we live in a world where we all wear masks. Kind of a goofy story, but it just gives you the picture. This guy's desperate for a job. He sees a one ad at a zoo, so he goes there, but the guy that works at the zoo says, the job, a little unusual, our gorilla died, and we can't afford to replace him with a real gorilla, so we'll pay you money to dress up in a gorilla suit and pretend to be a gorilla. And the guy says, well, that'd be kind of humiliating, but he's desperate for the money, so he does. Puts on the gorilla suit, gets in the cage, starts jumping around, beating his chest, grunting, and people start coming to watch him, and they kind of like what he's doing. He's kind of enjoying his job, but he gets a little too enthusiastic, and he's swinging on this vine. He swings over his wall into the next cage, which is where the lion is. And in a moment, the lion is on him, his paws on the guy's chest, and he panics and blows his cover and starts yelling, help, help, help! And the lion whispers to him, shut up, you idiot, or we'll both lose our jobs. But everybody in the zoo is wearing a mask, you know, welcome to the zoo. That's where we live. Everybody's wearing a mask. I'm okay. I'm doing great. Love it. Failure doesn't bother me. I got a happy mask. Going to church, I got a holy mask. I was getting ready for work this week, and this thought just came into my mind. Somebody that I know and that I think that I love, but my thought was, you know, I'm more successful than he is because I know more important people than he does. And then my next thought is, I just start to enjoy the truth of this by thinking about more important people that I know than this other guy. And then my next thought is, if I heard another human being say out loud that they were more important than somebody because they know more important people, I would think, what a pathetic, twisted, deluded idiot. But I think it, I just don't say it out loud. Except to all of you. So interesting. This is what Bonhoeffer writes. Confess your faults to one another. See, and this is what they found in the deep down dark. They started doing this down there. This is what they found in AA. This is what Bonhoeffer found. This is so profoundly true. He who is alone with his sin is utterly alone. It may be the Christians, notwithstanding corporate worship, common prayer, all their fellowship and service, we can do a lot of other stuff together, but we're still trapped, are still left to their loneliness. The final breakthrough to fellowship does not occur because though they have fellowship with one another as believers and as devout people, they do not have fellowship as the undevout, as sinners. The pious fellowship permits no one to be a sinner. So everybody must conceal his sin from himself and from the fellowship. We dare not be sinners. Many Christians are unthinkably horrified when a real sinner is suddenly discovered among the righteous. Oh no, a sinner, a real one. But in the fellowship of the deep down dark, see. Forgive me for abusing my body with drugs and alcohol. Somebody stumbles into AA and they're just sinners, just recovering sinners, and it's okay to say it. And as long as I'm hiding anything, I cannot be fully known and then I cannot be fully loved. Only if I'm fully known can I be fully loved? My secrets trap me in my aloneness. And so when I confess to God, not just in a general abstract, you know, I'm a sinner, forgive my anger, but I get real concrete, these words, this action. And then, guys, I'll just encourage you. I'll push you a little on this one. I have a couple of people I've known them for many, many years. You don't do this with a stranger. You have to know and trust somebody. But I got a couple of people where everything in my life, all my sin, my temptations, stuff that I'm embarrassed about, stuff that I would never tell all of you about, I'll tell them. And to have a fully disclosing friend is so liberating. And there's so much power in it. And that's what the church is meant to be. That's the fellowship of the deep dark down. And then one last observation. In the fellowship of the deep down dark, hope, love this, is non-perishable. So interesting. In the mine with those Chilean miners, they love to get together and they love to have El Pastor tell them stories in the Bible. Their favorite story from the Bible that they love to hear about down there was the story of Jonah and the whale. Want to guess why? That's their story. And if Jonah could get saved, maybe they could get saved. And they wanted to tell it to each other. This is a strange thing about hope. In order to keep hope, you got to give it away. Now, I've seen this over and over again. I've experienced this. When my focus is on me, am I going to be okay? I get suffocated in my aloneness. But I'm with other people. When I'm with them and when I care about them and I say, there's hope for you, hope comes to me. We live in a world that traffics in false hopes, shallow hopes, and will say to people things like, well, everything will turn out okay. I'm sure that you will get what you want. Maybe. But that's not the foundation of hope in the fellowship of the deep down dark. This is from that verse in Hebrews we looked at a moment ago. Let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds. Not giving up meeting together is the habit of some. Encouraging one another. And all the more as you see the day approaching. There's hope in the fellowship of the deep dark down. We encourage each other, but not based on maybes. As you see the day approaching. So interesting. That day is real clear to the guy writing and the people reading this, but you don't even say what it is. What's the day? What's the day that we see approaching? What's the day we're looking forward to? What's the day that gives us hope? What's the day you're waiting for? And I was just thinking about days that everybody looks forward to. In our society, people work and they just kill themselves working. So here's the day, Friday. We actually have a saying about this. What do we say about Friday? Thank God it's Friday. I don't have to work for 2 days. I live for Friday. A pathetic way to live. But there's people where, like, we got a whole restaurant chain. Just thank God it's Friday. That's kind of a miserable way to live. Now, before you work, you go to school. And you all know this. We're going to be praying. If you're in school, we all want to be praying for you because there could be so much weight and pressure and grades and tests and getting into the next school and weight around that is just crushing. And so for students in school, a lot of times they're waiting for graduation day. And then you graduate, you get out, you get to go into the real world, you get to make money, and you get to have a job, and you live with that one, and then you start looking forward to retirement day. That's a word that's not even in the Bible, retirement. And then retirement is difficult for people, and people are putting it off till longer and longer, and they're not having enough money for it. So then we wait for Powerball lottery payout day. don't applaud for that one. Anybody here know how much money is available right now if you win the Powerball lottery? It's like $950 million. It's just insane. And your odds of winning are like, you are 25 times more likely to be elected president of the United States. I was just reading that. Than you are to win the Powerball. But still, people are just going crazy in this. Somebody actually asked me last night, as Presbyterians, are we theologically sanctioned to play Powerball lottery? No. Of course not. No. But if you do and if you win, tithe. A Presbyterian is just a Baptist who tithes on their lottery winnings. That's all a Presbyterian is. So it's not that day. We're not looking for it. Well, what is the day? Well, here's the day. Long time ago, a little group of guys gathered together, and there was a guy that would teach him. He would tell him stories like nobody had ever told. And one day they hung this skinny guy on a cross, and they killed him, died for our sins. They buried him. Put a stone in front of him. He was blocked by the stone. way up above where nobody could see, there was a little rescue operation going on. And then the Heavenly Father came down and entered into that tomb and met with his crucified son. And there was the very, 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 very first meeting of the fellowship of the deep down dark. That stone got rolled away. And Jesus got up feeling good. That was the first resurrection day. And I'm here to tell you, there is another resurrection day coming. And when you hope, and when you read the Bible, and when you're with other Christians, and when you remember, and when you get buoyed up, and when you get encouraged, and when you get direction, and when you get forgiven, and when you get grace, you are seeing that day coming. And that's where our hope lies. Our hope is not in any human circumstance. Our hope is not that the girl might say yes. Our hope is not that the school might accept me. My hope is not that the job might come through. My hope is not that my house might appreciate, and I'll sell it one day for a whole lot of money. My hope is not that the 401k is going to be huge. My hope is not that the whale is going to deliver me up to the surface. My hope is not that the drill is going to make it all the way through the rock. My hope is that Jesus Christ, the skinny guy on the cross who was crucified for my sins, one day was resurrected, and the day is coming when I will be resurrected and you will too, and that is our hope. Amen. And in the meantime, gather together, we listen to the story, and we confess as sinners, and we share a little meal. And today, we're going to share that little meal. And we're going to do it together. You know, it's not called union, it's called communion, because we do it with Jesus at his table, but we do it together, just as forgiven sinners, as recovering sinners. So it's going to be a little messy as we come to the table this week. I'm going to ask Charlie to come on up and ask the team to come on out. And the way that we're going to do it is everybody's just actually going to go to one of these stations. If you're going to be delivering, serving communion, go to one of those stations now. Folks will hold the bread in the cup, and you can take the bread and dip it in the cup. And we're going to take it together, and there's going to be worship going on. And so if you're with some people, you might want to just express love to them. You might want to give them a hug. You might want to encourage them because the day's coming. You might want to tell them, don't forget to put your trust in the skinny guy. You might want to make a confession. Maybe there's somebody where you need forgiveness, and communion at the table, what a great time to ask for that. But we're just going to do this together as a family, kind of a messy way. So, Charlie, would you?